Thank you for inviting me. And I'll be talking about this work, which is done with, well, various different subsets of this group at Stanford, Savas Demopoulos, Jason Hogan, and Mark Kasevich, who are atomic experimentalists, Sergeant Regeneron, and Jay Wacker. So, first, why would we want to look for gravity waves? What's our motivation? So, I think it's fair to say that gravity waves are really a new band in which to view the universe. And just like whenever we've looked in other new bands, microwaves or x-rays, they have the potential to really teach us a lot. In particular, there are some, beyond that, there are some specific good reasons for thinking that we may learn a lot from gravity waves. They can give us some really unique information we can't get other ways. So, of course, they're sourced by large conglomerations of mass, not charge, so we've only ever looked in electromagnetic waves before, look at the universe. And because they come from some coherent radiation from large masses, this could really potentially provide pretty unique astrophysical information, teach us about objects that are essentially invisible to electromagnetic radiation, like compact object binaries or black holes, maybe providing strong field GR tests. There's an interesting idea to do with Schutz. Maybe gravity waves can provide a new measure of distance, a new measure of the expansion of the universe.
How do you do that?
Well, the basic idea is a compact object binary, at the end of its lifetime, is its primary energy loss mechanism is gravitational. So it's you can sort of think of them as just two-point objects in spiraling gravitationally. So it's a very well-defined system. It makes a standard candle. So, and then from various properties of the gravitational radiation you can see, you can figure out the distance, luminosity distance, to the object. However, there's sort of a small but probably big caveat, which is you do need an optical, you need to see it optically. You need to determine a redshift somehow. So there are still people thinking about that, but there's a lot of reasons to believe that will probably be hard.
Probably hard.
I mean, I know some people are still working on it. I don't want to claim one way or the other.
Some astrophysicist was telling me this morning that there are a lot of binary black holes.
That's what they expect. Yeah, there's a lot of and this could also come from neutron stars.
Couldn't you just get the redshift from the gravity waves?
No, I think not, is the answer.
There's no spectral lines.
What?
There are no lines.
I know, but if you really had a theory of the wave.
Yeah, I really knew it.
That's the scale with the masses, right?
There may be some degeneracy with the mass and so another interesting property of gravity waves is that the universe is essentially transparent to gravity waves, because gravity is such a weak force, they just fly right through clouds of gas and dust, and even right through the early universe, so they're not thermalized. And this will hopefully provide us with one of the few ways we have of studying early universe cosmology before last scattering. And along these lines, people talk about specific sources, gravity waves from inflation or reheating, or from early universe phase transitions, maybe from cosmic strings. And these are, of course, more speculative, but I think they're also pretty exciting. And this is one of the really important reasons, I think, that we want to look for gravity waves. One of the pretty unique pieces of information gravity waves might be able to provide us. So, okay, why am I then talking about atom interferometry? So, what is it? The particular type I'll be talking about, light pulse atom interferometry, was demonstrated first by Kasevich and Chu in the early 90s, and many times since then by many people around the world. And this technology, this atomic technology, has been really rapidly advancing. So it's pretty much the same technology, or uses the same technology, as involved in atom cooling and Bose-Einstein condensation and atomic clocks. And they've made orders of magnitude progress in the last decade or so. And they've already reached great precisions. Atomic clocks can remain synchronous to something like 16 digits. And the experimentalists tell us they see many avenues for future improvements. So they don't see any reason this rapid rate of progress is going to stop soon. And they've done some things, they tested some fundamental physics for this. For example, the atomic clocks have looked for time variation of alpha, which is already constraining it at about the same level as cosmological tests. But our feeling is there really has to be more fundamental physics to be done with it. This is a great tool, and there must be some other things that we can do. So I'm going to tell you about our ideas. So I'll begin by just reviewing briefly what atom interferometry is, everything we need to know for this talk. And then I want to talk about our proposals for using it to look for gravity waves, and tell you some of our proposed experiments and what the projected sensitivities might be and what kind of potential sources you'd have access to. Then if there's time, I'll also talk about some of our ideas for looking for testing GR and looking for new short-range forces using atom interferometry. So first, what is atom interferometry? So I'll begin by describing an atomic clock, because this is essentially the sort of simplest example of an atom interferometer. And this will just be a really crude theorist picture, what I understand about an atomic clock. So imagine I have an atom with two internal atomic energy levels, some energy splitting between them. And I'm going to start the atom just entirely in state one. I'll always be talking if this is just a single atom. Of course, in reality, in order to get as much statistic as possible, you want to cool and trap and do this process to as many atoms as possible. And you should think now they can maybe cool and trap a cloud of about a million atoms at a time. So that's a number to keep in mind. But because I'll, for the purpose of this talk, I'll be considering those atoms always independent. They're not talking to one another. They're just a cold cloud. So we can just talk about what happens to a single atom. Okay, then you put it through what they call a beam splitter. I'll describe this in more detail later, but the whole effect is to split the state into a superposition of the two internal atomic energy levels. Then, not too surprisingly, if you wait some time, t, you pick up a relative phase between the two levels given by their energy splitting times the time. Put it through a final beam splitter. Beam splitter is just a linear process, just takes each of these states, one and two, and does exactly the same thing to them, splits them in two. So one is split into some combination of states one and two, and this two is also split into some combination of states one and two. And then you get these coefficients here, note the minus sign for unitarity, you get the coefficients here that are functions of this phase shift. And now the amplitude of the coefficient is dependent on the phase shift. So what you do is you measure the number of atoms in state one versus state two, and I'll be calling this the two output ports. You measure these numbers, but I guess the square of this number. So measuring the number of atoms in state one and state two then provides some measurement of this phase, the phase shift that state two has picked up relative to state one. And if I can imagine, for example, let's say I can measure this phase even to just the order one radian, then I can see times which are as small as one over this atomic energy splitting, which for a typical atomic energy splitting you might be talking about is maybe some 10 to the minus 10 seconds. And you can do even better if you have more atom flux. So this, I think, is kind of getting at why atomic clocks and why interferometers in general are so precise. You're measuring some macroscopic quantity, like the time, in terms of a microscopic ruler. So in this case, the energy splitting of the atom. Or in the case of a light interferometer, you're measuring some large distance in terms of the wavelength of the light. So you have some very fine ruler, very precise ruler, to measure your macroscopic quantity. And this is why atom interferometer, or why interferometers in general are so precise. Okay, so this is sort of the simplest realization of an atom interferometer, but it turns out, for reasons I'll talk about it in a little bit, we can't actually use quite this simple an atom interferometer. So we have to use a slightly different kind of atom interferometer. So what I'm drawing here now is a space-time diagram of the atom interferometer, and these blue and green lines are the spatial trajectories of the atom. So what's happening? What is this saying? Again, I start with my atom, really my cold cloud of atoms, all in some internal atomic state, one. And now let's just imagine they're launched with some initial momentum. Maybe this is thrown up above the surface of the Earth, some momentum p. Then they're put through a beam splitter. And this beam splitter will be essentially the same as before. It'll take this atom in state one and split into a linear superposition of states one and two. But now it also has the effect of giving state two an extra momentum kick, k. So of course, then it begins to separate on this space-time diagram. Half of the atom is essentially moving a little bit faster than the other half. So I have one atom thrown up above the surface of the Earth, say. Then one half of the atom gets a kick, so it begins to rise above the other half. So the two halves spatially separate. Put through what we call a mirror, or what's called a mirror. All this does is make the initially slow half fast, and the initially fast half slow. So you essentially switch which state it's in, and you switch which has the momentum. The whole point of this is that then the two halves can come back together, so they can meet at this final point where they can be re-interfered by a final beam splitter, because of course they have to overlap in order to actually see an interference pattern. And then again, I can measure the relative numbers of atoms in these two output ports, and this gives me some measure of this phase shift that one half of the atom has picked up with respect to the other half. And I should say these don't actually even have to be different atomic energy levels now, just the splitting on the space-time diagram is enough. And that's kind of why I'm calling this space-time interferometry. You'll see in a second sort of where you're getting a lot of the power of this is from the fact that these paths are split on a space-time diagram. Notice I've actually just drawn this as if it's just a single spatial axis, and it can be. The atoms, if you just launch them, say, above the surface of the Earth, they just rise up, the two halves separate, and then they come back together after this mirror pulse, meet at a final point, and they're re-interfered. They've taken exactly the same spatial trajectory. They've just gone in a straight line upwards. Of course, if you did that with a light interferometer, you wouldn't have split the light at all. There would be no phase shift. But because the atom is not necessarily moving, its velocity is changeable. It's not just moving at a constant speed. You can have this splitting, this opening on a space-time diagram, and that's kind of where the sensitivity of the atom interferometer comes from.
You're going to tell us how this mirror looks, right?
Absolutely. In fact, that's my next slide. So this is the only atom interferometer, the only atomic physics we need to know for this talk. I need to tell you how do the beam splitters and mirrors actually work. So the basic trick is this. Take the atom and put it in the presence of two counterpropagating laser pulses coming at the atom, of just the right frequencies, these red and purple frequencies here, to couple a ground atomic state 1 with some other hyperfine split ground atomic state 2 here via a highly excited intermediate atomic state. And in fact, actually, you want to drive a virtual transition through this state, so you don't actually populate any of that state, because we don't want any of the atom going there. The idea of this is, I've said, we want an opening on the space-time diagram. We want as much extra splitting between the velocities as possible, which means we want to give this atom as big a momentum kick as possible. So what happens? Well, you can see the red lasers are absorbed. The purple laser causes stimulated emission. So there you get two photon kicks in the same direction, because these are counterpropagating. So the atom picks up a net momentum, which is roughly the frequency of a laser. So lasers are about optical, so that's about an EV. But the nice thing is, by having absorption and stimulated emission, I have an energy splitting here between the states 1 and 2 that's small. The difference in the frequencies, so for the atoms we'll be talking about, that's about 10 to the minus 5 EV, turns out. And of course, that's important because I want to get as big a momentum kick as possible, but I need this state 2 to be long-lived. I need it to not decay during the time of my interferometer, which we want to be as long as possible, which will be about seconds. So you probably want as low an energy splitting as possible in some two-photon process, so this state 2 is long-lived. So I've told you how I can give the atom kicks, but then why does this make a beam splitter or a mirror? So okay, what have you got? You've got, forget this intermediate state because it's virtual, I'll assume it's irrelevant. I've essentially got a two-level quantum system, and when I turn on this laser light, it's a coupling. You have a coupling between the two levels. So of course, we all know what's going to happen. It's going to Rabi flop. So here I'm plotting the coefficient of the amount of the state of the atom in state 1 versus state 2. Versus the time that the light is on, that the coupling between the two states is on, units of the Rabi-Flaupin period. So, for example, let's say here I turn on the light at time 0, and the atom starts entirely in state 1. That's the beginning of the interferometer. Then if I wait for a time pi over 2, if I turn the light on for this precise time pi over 2, then you can see I get to a point where the atom is half in state 1 and half in state 2, and that's a beam splitter. Similarly, if I wait for a time pi, a pi pulse, is a mirror. The atom is switched entirely from state 1 into state 2. So that's how you make the beam splitters and mirrors. That's essentially all the atomic physics we need to know. Just short pulses of light split the atom and then serve to recombine it.
So there's one more question, which is, why doesn't this dewinter the atom?
good. So of course, all the magic is that they can do this without dewintering the atom. Right. It's a critical point. You know, There's a lot of answers to that question because there's a lot of possible ways it could decohere. But some things you might be worried about. The laser is a coherent state. It cannot be described as just a bunch of sort of individual photons flying at the atom cloud. So all the atoms aren't just hit stochastically, randomly, as if they had a cross section. They all move together. This is one atom, but they all transition together over exactly the same time period because they're just, in fact, you can sort of ignore the fact that it's a coherent state, just talk about it as some background electric field that it's providing to the atom, which is this coupling between the two states. One of the critically important points is that when the laser interacts with the atom, when this beam splitter interacts with the atom, the state of the laser is not appreciably changed. But of course, you know that's going to happen. If you allow me to sort of abuse what a laser really is for a second, imagine that when the atom is transitioning, it's as if it's absorbing one photon out of the laser. That's not really what it's doing, but let's imagine that's what it's doing. So let's say I take a coherent state of the light and I apply an annihilation operator to it. Well, you know, it basically doesn't change.
Well, this is actually my confusion, because it does change from a finable state, even the number doesn't change very much. If that was...
No, that's the interesting thing about a coherent state. It's in fact, sort of.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Theoretically, a coherent state would be an eigenstate of the annihilation operator.
Quite right.
In fact, if you use a number state of the light, which they've done and you can do, you get a perfectly orthogonal state of the light And you can see, you totally destroy interference, and the fact they've actually demonstrated that experimentally, which is kind of cool. So it absolutely relies on not appreciably changing the state of the laser light as it passes through.
What was N for the
experiment? N, which N?
How many photons?
Oh, how many photons? That I don't know, unfortunately. Okay. So then this is really the space-time diagram of interferometer. So I have the atom coming in, it's split by these short pulses of laser light, and then recombined. And I'm always trying to be careful to describe this atom interferometer in a relativistic way, because one of the things we had to do was develop a sort of GR formalism, or method for doing this, the calculation, method for figuring out what phase shift you're going to get in the atom interferometer. And this is a bit tricky because, of course, we want to talk about, well, I want to talk about gravity waves, also want to think about GR tests. So I want to think about how do I solve this atom interferometer? How do I find the phase shift at the end in some general metric background? Well, in general, solving the full Schrodinger equation in some random metric background is impossible or very difficult. Luckily, then, we can take the sort of a much simpler semi-classical approximation. I won't describe in detail how this actually works. But the basic way it works is you take this, you calculate the final phase shift in terms of three contributions. So the propagation phase is kind of what you all expect, the simplest thing. It's just the phase that the atom picks up free propagating between any of these laser pulses. So due to the potential or whatever else is around. There's also phases at each interaction point. Every time it interacts with the laser, it turns out it picks up the phase of the laser. The nice thing is you can calculate that because it's sort of at a very local point. It's essentially irrelevant what the metric background is. That's one of the simplifications. So it essentially just picks up the phase of the laser at this point. And that's why you can kind of think of the atom interferometer as comparing the atom's phase with the laser's phase. That'll be important later. And finally, if the two halves of the atom don't actually overlap at this end point, there's some phase shift that arises from the distance, their distance, they're separated divided there by their wavelength. So I want to basically skip all the details of this. I just want to tell you how we do this GR calculation. So imagine I have some atom interferometer sitting on the surface of the Earth. What's it going to see? Well, here's some space-time diagram for the atom falling back towards the Earth. And this is, so for example, if I'm in the Schwarzschild metric, phi is the Newtonian gravitational potential of the Earth. Actually, phi is 10 to the minus 9, so it's really not relevant to the Schwarzschild metric. I just take some expansion. What we want then, because I'm in the semi-classical approximation, I just need the classical trajectories of the atom and of the light. So I just find the geodesics of this metric for the atom and for the light. That turns out to be pretty important too, the effect of gravity on the light. Find where they interfere correctly, relativistically at the momentum, etc. And there isn't anything particularly tricky about this. It turns out the algebra is very ugly, and we do it on a computer symbolic algebra package. But the one sort of small subtlety I want to mention, you always have to work in what I'll call physical variables, or the things the experimentalist actually measures, of course, because GR, you never want to fool yourself and actually derive some coordinate-dependent answer that doesn't mean anything. So for example, I've been labeling this T, this time coordinate T. Well, it's not actually T. If we'll always define times in terms of the time kept on the laser's clock here. The laser sitting at position 0 defines some clock. So this time coordinate was really T over root G 0, 0. Similarly, the laser's four momentum, which we need for these momentum, has to be defined in terms of what an observer would see, etc. So okay, but really, I just want to skip the details of that whole calculation and get on to motivating what the answer is. So what does an atom interferometer see sitting on the surface of the Earth in some constant gravitational field? So I'll just talk about it. It's good enough for our purposes to pretend it all comes from this propagation phase. Well, the propagation phase is this phase the atom's picking up. If you think, like, in terms of the Feynman path integral, it's just the integral of Lagrangian dt, or said relativistically, that's m d tau, or p mu dx mu. So then you can see what this is telling you. The phase of the atom is essentially the atom's clock, and it ticks at a rate given by the atom's rest mass. So then, okay, what does this atom interferometer see when it's in the gravitational field of the Earth? Okay, integrating the Lagrangian, essentially, you know what's going to happen. Half of the atom is higher than the other half. So it's at a different place in the potential. It has a different potential energy given by mg times the height splitting between the two. So the phase it picks up is that times the time. And of course, I've said we want to get as much height splitting as possible to get as much sensitivity as possible, as large a signal as possible. So you want as much momentum kick between the two as possible, because the height splitting, of course, is the extra velocity it picks up, k over m, times the time. And so finally, you find the phase shift in this gravitational field is given by the K of the laser, which is about 1 eV, G, say, for the Earth, and at times, time for these typical laboratory experiments will be about a second. That's just limited by the drop time. The atoms are free falling here, and eventually they hit the floor, bottom of the apparatus. So if I plug in 1 eV, G, for the Earth in 1 second, I find a phase shift of about 10 to the 8 radians. This should be compared to a sensitivity for these devices, think generally of about 10 to the minus 6 radians. That comes from, I said, you can cool and launch about a million atoms per shot right now. And a shot takes on the order of seconds, so a grad student is willing to wait for maybe about a million shots before he wants to be done with his thesis. So root n, that's 10 to the 12 total atoms through your experiment, so root n tells you you have a sensitivity phase shifts about 10 to the minus 6 radians. So this is giving you, you can see then, this is a very precise accelerometer. You can very precisely measure the atom down to 10 to the minus 14 or 15 little g for this kind of experiment. And it's hand-waving, but I want to give you the intuition that where a lot of this sensitivity is coming from is the fact that this is space-time interferometry, as I said. So you can kind of consider one arm length of the atom interferometer to be this time t, which is about a second, and that's about the Earth-Moon distance. So you can imagine how sensitive LIGO would be if they had arm lengths of the Earth-Moon distance. It's hand-waving, but it's roughly fair. Okay, so just to sort of reiterate what I've talked about, well, first, this is a space-time diagram of an atomic clock now, this kind of language I've been using. So the atom comes in, it's split by some initial beam splitter, split into states 1 and 2. Maybe they have some momentum splitting between them as well. And then it's just re-interfered by a final beam splitter. If you actually want to re-interfere them, these two points had better be very close, so they overlap, they're within a wave function. And this measures time, as we saw. I would like to argue that actually this provides a very good measure of velocity. Because if I have some atomic clock moving this back to me, and it's sending me regular laser signals at every tick of the clock, there's, of course, a linear Doppler shift. And that's actually a very big effect of what we're talking about. So that's a very precise way to measure the velocity with respect to you of the clock. This sort of then explains why this pulse sequence is an accelerometer. So this is the diamond pulse sequence we were just talking about. The atom comes in, it's split by a beam splitter, mirrored and recombined. And you can see this essentially looks like two clocks, one negated and put on top of the other. So the linear in time phase shifts cancel out of this. And what I see then is something that changes in time between the first half and the second half. So if the first half is a clock and measuring velocity, I see the change of velocity in time between the first half and second half. So I take a time derivative. So I'm measuring, this is why, or hand-waving way of saying why this is measuring acceleration. This is useful intuition because it then gives you an idea about what else you can do. So, for example, here's another thing you can do with this. Add another mirror pulse. Make two diamonds out of this. So negate this accelerometer, put it on top again, it measures another time derivative, so I can measure the time derivative of acceleration. I can keep doing this with many, many diamonds. And what am I kind of building up here? I'm building up something that's sensitive to a time-varying signal that's changing in time with about the period of this diamond here. So that nicely gets rid of a lot of backgrounds, things like the constant gravity of the Earth or something, for example. But we'll pick out, say, a gravity wave. That's precisely the signal of gravity. It's something that's changing in time, roughly sinusoidal. Okay, so those are some of the tools you have to work with when designing some atom interferometry experiment. Now I just want to take a brief digression and tell you about the experiment they're building right now at Stanford. So you're looking into a pit in the basement of the Stanford Physics Building. You have about a 10-meter tube going down to that pit. And the atoms just run right down the center of this tube. So the atoms are cooled and trapped at the bottom, launched upwards. They rise to the top and fall back down. Of course, the whole reason for being 10 meters is just so you have as much drop time as possible. We saw you got more sensitivity with more time. They're actually doing this. They're gonna run two simultaneous atom interferometers with rubidium 85 and rubidium 87. And they're doing this to drop the two together, essentially, and test the principle of equivalence. And this, initially, it'll be sensitive. As I motivate, you'll have sensitivity to forces about 10 to the minus 15 little g. So it'll be a 15-digit test of the equivalence principle, which is some order of magnitude or more better than the current limits. Okay, so, but we really want to think about how can we use this technology to see gravity waves. And I want to begin by describing it in analogy with LIGO. So, and you'll see then there are some similarities and some differences with LIGO. So, okay, recall, what is LIGO? You have these laser interferometer that has 2 4-kilometer long arms. And crudely, roughly, you can think of it as very precisely laser ranging this free-floating test mass, the mirror that's at the end there. you're just very precisely watching the motion of the test mass, looking for the effect of a gravity wave passing through. And roughly, I would say, an atom interferometer is kind of the same thing. It's like very precisely laser ranging the atom. We saw you can very carefully measure the atom's motion, say its acceleration, with this technique. So roughly, the signals will be the same. So here, what is actually the signal of a gravity wave passing through? So here's a toy metric for a gravity wave. This is a plane gravity wave traveling in the z direction, some transverse stretching and squeezing of space with amplitude h and frequency omega. And what do you see, for example, if I were to compare two clocks at one position, x equals 0 and x equals l? So this is a space-time diagram. I plotted here the null geodesics of this metric. And if this clock is just sending out signals at a constant time interval, you can see that they don't arrive at anything like a constant time interval at the other clock, precisely because of this gravity wave here. I've plotted the phase of the gravity wave. And that's essentially the signal, either for LIGO, that's one way of saying what LIGO signal is, or for us. It's this screwed-up relation between the timing of two clocks, say, or the distance that light pulses travel to the mirror. More precisely, though, I've said we're not actually going to use a clock. And the basic answer is the reason we're not going to use a clock is because a clock is sensitive, as I said, to velocities. So if I have some, one of my atom is moving with some even tiny velocity with respect to me, that's a huge background for a gravity wave experiment. So we don't want that. Instead, we want to use this accelerometer. We want to measure accelerations. So, okay, what's the real signal then? So here's the gravity wave metric. It's not too hard to believe that if I'm laser ranging some test mass, atom or mirror, starting at x equals 0, laser ranging it, it's maybe a distance L away. I'm going to see a distance that's roughly L, but varying sinusoidally with amplitude HL and frequency omega. And I said, okay, we're sensitive to the acceleration of the atom. So what's the acceleration that I'm going to see if the laser is carefully laser ranging the atom? Well, I'll take two time derivatives. You see some acceleration proportional to HL omega squared. Or then you can guess, I motivated why you see a phase shift that goes like KAT squared. So you can guess then that this is the phase shift of a gravity wave passing through an atom interferometer. Proportional to the length between the atom and the laser, and also proportional, of course, to the strain and the size of the interferometer. Now, I said a real GR calculation, carefully done, bears this out. You can see this is the actual answer, or the leading order piece of the actual answer. If you expand this in the limit that the interferometer is small, so the size T and L of the interferometer are less than 1 over omega, the size of the gravity wave, then you just precisely reproduce this formula. Of course, what these signs here are doing for you, as you take T and L to be larger, your sensitivity goes up. Your signal size goes up as you make the experiment bigger, of course. But at some point, when T or L get to be bigger than the period of the gravity wave, you're averaging over more than one period, you're no longer increasing sensitivity that way, and that's what these signs are doing for you. So then, let me start sort of building up the experiment. So what's a quick cartoon of this signal that I've been developing? So here we're just running the same atom interferometer, the same beam splitter mirror, beam splitter pulse sequence, some distance L from this laser here. So a space-time diagram. Or if you imagine in some spatial picture, I'm running some, say, smallish. I'll always imagine, say, this 10-meter atom interferometer that they're building at Stanford. Some large distance from the laser. You want as large a distance as possible in order to get as much signal as possible. So I'll start by imagining a kilometer, but the real question is how big a distance can you get? Now, of course, as I've said on the previous slide, this would have a signal of a gravity wave. You could see this time-varying phase shift. That's what you're looking for. That's the same thing that LIGO is looking for, some oscillatory phase shift in the interferometer. But this is a lot.
Excuse me. Yeah. When you were talking about building up these time derivatives, mm-hmm. did you have to put in the period of the gravitational wave or the frequency you're looking for?
So if I was actually going to be doing many, many, many of those diamonds, which is one possible idea, you can see that you're only sensitive to gravity waves whose period is about the time length of a diamond. So that's a resonant detector, actually. That detector has much, turns out, I won't explain why exactly, but it has much more sensitivity, but only to gravity waves whose period is about that. So it's a sharply resonant detector. But you probably won't be surprised to learn that this kind of setup will be much maximally sensitive to a gravity wave whose period is about t. It does work that way, actually, as you can see from this formula here. You're maximally sensitive if the gravity wave's frequency is about t. T will always be much longer than L in our case. So. So that's what your peak sensitivity is doing. Okay, so, but this is a lot like one arm of LIGO. One arm of LIGO has a gravity wave signal as well, but you can never actually see a gravity wave that way or this way because it would be swamped by noise. And one of the major noise sources is, I've said that this is a lot like, the atom's phase here is a lot like the atom's clock, and you're comparing it to the laser's clock over here. Well, the laser doesn't keep perfect time. Any laser, no matter how good, has some phase noise in it, which means the phase fronts don't come at exactly equal intervals. That turns out to be very large compared to the gravity wave signal we're talking about. Same as for LIGO too. And so you really need, LIGO needs a reference arm, which has the same laser phase noise. You split the same laser beam, goes down the two arms, but of course the gravity wave signal will be different between them. So we want to use the same basic idea. The trick we can use here is a differential measurement between two simultaneous atom interferometers run with the same laser pulses as beam splitters and mirrors. And so any phase noise that's in the laser gets added the same way at each vertex, so it comes in the same way at each interferometer, so it cancels when we take the differential measurement. So you can essentially, and of course this has a gravity wave because this atom is very close to the laser, so it has essentially no signal of the gravity wave. This distance, the baseline here, is very small. And this atom interferometer has essentially all the signal of a gravity wave because the baseline is very big. So you haven't canceled your signal. You do still have a signal of a gravity wave. Roughly, or hand waving, you can think of this like comparing the two clocks, this two sort of atomic clocks here. Or you can think of it like one atom is very carefully laser arranging the other. Now, I've essentially described to you our proposal for a terrestrial experiment. So our proposed terrestrial experiment is this. Have some long vertical mine shaft. I haven't said why it has to be vertical. Actually, we're not even totally sure it has to be, but it was, in the case that it was vertical, we could prove, or we could show that these major backgrounds you worry about are in fact controllable and not a problem. So that's why so far we've thought vertical. Obviously, for practical reasons, you might also want to consider whether it works horizontally. So okay, take some long mine shaft. Mines that work for this, we've talked to people, apparently there are a ton of mines that are about a kilometer long, although nothing more than a few kilometers long. So this is something order of a kilometer is about a reasonable distance. Take two of these 10 meter atom interferometers, place one at the top and one at the bottom of the mine shaft, and then run it with these common laser signals along this single vertical laser axis. So as I said, one of the nice things about taking this differential measurement between these two interferometers is that it cancels a lot of backgrounds. It cancels, critically cancels laser phase noise. And also, it allows you, because these atom interferometers are fairly small, it allows you to really scale up the signals, take a very long baseline. It's much harder to make these atom interferometers themselves very big. They require hard vacuum and good magnetic shielding. This is sort of an expensive region here, whereas just having a laser propagating between them is quite easy, assuming you just have the distance. Now, I've said that our peak sensitivity for this kind of experiment will be about 1 hertz, about the time length of this experiment. Some of you may know that that's sort of noticeably lower than LIGO's frequency range, and one of the reasons LIGO can't get there, they could potentially get there, but they have they hit a seismic wall. They have huge background just coming from vibrations of the Earth, which end up, even with all their vibration isolation, end up coupling to their mirrors. And that prevents, even advanced LIGO won't be able to go below about 10 hertz. So you might wonder, well, do we have just exactly the same problem? But the answer is our atoms are a lot like LIGO's mirrors. So they're free falling. They're not attached to the Earth in any way. So they're completely isolated from vibrations. So we just instantly erase that problem. There is no seismic problem. And actually, I should say, to be precise, that's to leading order. I haven't told you exactly why. It can come back in through some of the oscillation of the laser, but that's at a much higher order and a different frequency. At a much higher frequency where it's a lot easier to control, but actually where it's just naturally much smaller.
So each interferometer has these bunches of atoms which are being launched.
Exactly.
Now, how accurately do you have to, you know, coordinate the two bunches so that they're launched at exactly the same time?
Good. Well, actually, the launch doesn't need to be exactly the same time. That's not too bad. But what certainly needs to be at the same time is the beam splitters and mirrors. And of course, that's done, you just literally have the exact same laser pulse here traveling through the cavity.
Each bunch has to be in motion at the time that pulse.
Each bunch is sent up sometime before, that's right, down here. And then you just wait, they're free falling through the cavity, and you just turn on the lasers for a brief period of time. That's it. Same thing as just one atom interferometer, actually. Now I should say, in practice, it turns out for reasons that we were mentioning at lunch, you probably want these velocities to be fairly similar because they do end up coupling in higher order through the Newtonian gravity of the Earth surrounding it. So they need to be fairly similar, but that's okay too, because you use lasers to launch the atoms. So you just do the exact same thing again, just have some laser pulse down here that launches both atoms together.
Do you have to worry about the rotation of the Earth?
Absolutely. And so in fact, let me mention backgrounds. So I won't go through it in detail, but I've said what some of the most important backgrounds for LIGO are vibrations and laser phase noise. Those are canceled, like I said, at least the leading order. So allowing us to get to lower frequencies. It turns out the most important background is what LIGO calls time-varying gravity gradient noise. It just means the Earth is shaking. That shaking for LIGO couples in just directly through their support system holding up the pendulum. But even if you don't have any, even if your atoms are free-falling, it's still going to couple through Newtonian gravity to the atom. And of course, there's no way to screen that. This turns out, because of the very high sensitivities we're talking about, to be the major background for us, and it's even a major, or starting to be a major background for advanced LIGO. Okay, obviously, especially here in California, we're pretty interested in how the Earth shakes, so we've recorded this. So it turns out we'll only care if the Earth is shaking at frequencies that we're sensitive to, so around 1 hertz, if they can look like a signal. Turns out the amplitude of the power of these oscillations at around 1 hertz. It's about a tenth of a micron per root hertz. And some people have done a careful analysis of this for LIGO, and it turns out the most important things are surface waves on the Earth. So there are other oscillations, but the most important are surface waves. So this is about the height of these surface waves, about a tenth of a micron per root hertz in our frequency band. And they have some wavelength, which turns out for a hertz to be about a kilometer. So then this tells you how much mass is in this surface wave, so it tells you how strongly it couples to the atom. Compare this to the acceleration caused by your gravity wave, hL omega squared. And this gives some constraint in the h omega plane on what kind of gravity wave you can see. And for us, it'll turn out, this will set our lower limit on frequency. We can only see gravity waves down to maybe a third of a hertz. This is sort of one still unfortunate fact. You thought you'd gotten rid of a lot of LIGO's problems, vibrations, laser phase noise, you can go to lower frequencies. But there is still this limit that seems irreducible, seems impossible to get rid of. Now, this is the most important background. I won't talk about any of the others, but rotations, for example, are a good example of things that are actually a big background. Also, magnetic fields, the atom response is strong in magnetic fields, timing errors, launch position, jitter. Our statement is that every background we've been able to think of seems controllable, but not necessarily easy. I mean, a gravity wave experiment is in general hard, but it seems controllable. When I say that, I mean with current technology, what we've already done. So, for example, on rotations, an atom interferometer is only sensitive to rotations if it actually has spatial opening, not just opening on a space-time diagram. So it has to be split in more than one spatial dimension. Now, they always will. I mean, there will be some thermal velocity splitting them. But that's why it starts out not too large. Actually, it's still probably measurable just with those thermal velocities, but probably controllable. It's roughly common to the two as well, so it tends to cancel out. Okay, I don't want to talk much more about backgrounds. Yes?
So the idea is that you're running this thing continuously?
You're continually taking shots, that's right. So,
a shot a second or something?
Roughly a shot. Actually, you want to take as many shots as possible.
So it's hard to imagine doing another year. Is that possible?
Oh, yeah, they've already done that, for sure. Well, like I said, grad students are only willing to wait for maybe weeks. I mean, the current atom experiments are tabletop. They're done by a couple people. So they wait for weeks. But yeah, they have these things. They're just automatic atom coolers and trappers. They cool and trap every few seconds. They launch, and they just keep going like that for weeks, and they don't see any reason that they had to stop at weeks. I mean, they could easily see running it for years. So,
is it possible to use a dot to reduce background?
Absolutely. In fact, I didn't mention it, but that's one of the things a tool we have that may be very important if necessary, because that generally gets rid of a lot of gravity gradients and stuff. So, absolutely, that's an important tool you have if you need it, and it's about at the level you might start to need it. Okay. So I've said that we would like, you'd actually see a lot of reasons we'd like to go to lower frequency, look at lower frequency gravity waves, but we're limited here on the Earth just by this fairly fundamental limit. Also, to see a gravity wave, you really want as much baseline as possible. And again, you're limited on the Earth by roughly kilometers. So both those reasons are actually roughly the same reasons that for light interferometers, you want to think about going to space, doing a satellite-based version of the experiment. So same for us. We've considered how well you could do if you did make a satellite version of this experiment for those reasons. So the basic idea of the experiment is the exact same thing. just a single long common laser axis with two atom interferometers. These are the paths of the atoms here. Run at either end of the laser axis. Now I'm imagining, say, running it between two satellites, very similar to LISA. And now, of course, because you're in space, you can have a much longer baseline, we think up to maybe about 1,000 kilometers. And another one of the nice features of space is you have, well, much more time. The atoms aren't falling under gravity, so they don't hit the floor of the device, which means it will allow us to get much longer interrogation times T, or sensitivity to lower frequency gravity waves.
What's limiting your length?
The length? Oh, this? Good. So I still need, the laser spreads a significant amount over that length. So I need enough power at the far end to drive the atomic transitions.
So it's laser technology.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, yeah, absolutely. So potentially advances in that make advances in the sensitivity we can get to. Now, I could have thought about just running the atom interferometer inside the satellite itself, but that has the limitation, well, satellite can't be very big. So you have to still have a fairly small interferometer region, and we'd like to get as much time as possible with as much momentum splitting as possible. But we believe, though I certainly don't claim to be an expert in this, we've been satellite experiments, but we believe that it's actually reasonable to do the atom interferometer out just in the vacuum of space itself, so just launch the atom out from the satellite, because we believe that the statement is the vacuum space, the magnetic fields in space, etc., are all good enough for what you need for this atomic interferometer region. So the vacuum space is actually very hard, about as hard as they use anyway in the lab.
Is this going to be a vertical separation again? I mean, are you supposed to?
So this will be a separation along this same laser axis, exactly. Laser comes along, kicks one half of the atom, so it begins to move a little bit faster in this direction.
Right.
So it's horizontal on this diagram, but.
But it would be vertical with respect to the Earth.
Well, it depends where the satellites are.
They can, you had some reason why it had to be vertical on this.
Oh, no, that was just essentially because they fall significantly towards the Earth. Now, the satellite's falling too, so they all fall together.
So, you said it's because they fall, but you also didn't like the arrangement with both interferometers.
Oh, I see. Like this, but separated.
Yeah, but you need them to be separated.
The problem is if they're moving like, if they're separated like this, so 10 meters, 10 meters here, some kilometer apart on the Earth, you have two axes, one that kicks up and one that kicks this way. And this, the one that kicks up is uncommon. It's not the same for the two. So it has a source of noise. So if the Earth jitters here, but not here, that's noise. There are potentially ways to get around it, but that's not something, that's what made me really worried and not want to consider it. Okay, now, just to mention, one of the sort of advantages of this setup is I can fire the atom from the satellite, but not actually start the interferometer, not pulse the first beam splitter pulse until the atom is some distance away from the satellite. This has the great advantage that it turns out, even though the satellite's very small, we're talking about such precise sensitivities that the satellite's coupling to the atom just through Newtonian gravity is still the background. And this actually is one of the major backgrounds for LISA. This is one of the ones that's on LISA sensitivity as well. But one of the helps here, LISA's mirror sits right inside the satellite. Here, the atom is far from it, or can be, we hope, far from it. That can greatly reduce the Newtonian gravity between it, and is one of the things that allows us to get to good sensitivity. So now I've mentioned briefly, I want to give sort of a comparison about some of the things that we think, well, some of the things that are different between this experiment and LISA. So I've already said we're imagining baselines for a LISA equivalent sensitivity experiment. We're imagining baselines of maybe about 1,000 kilometers. LISA is about 5 million kilometers. And this, of course, difference, our baseline can be shorter for the same sensitivity because this is, again, space-time interferometry. We're using this long time axis. This is a pretty technical requirement, but like I said, it's also actually maybe one of the most important. LISA has to, for various reasons, control their satellite very well. It has to be very drag-free, very inertial proof mass. And it turns out they need to control it to maybe a nanometer per root hertz in this frequency band that they're looking at, which is about 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 3 hertz. For a couple of reasons, mainly this thing, in fact, I just said that our atom can be far from the satellite, so it has a reduced coupling to the satellite. Also because the atom is, in general, just a good inertial proof mass. Our requirement is about 4 orders of magnitude easier, maybe 10 microns per hertz. We believe that this number has already been demonstrated. People have made drag-free satellites, but this number, people tell us, is one of the major challenges of LISA. This is one of the things that's going to be hard. Similarly, they have fairly large floating proof masses inside their satellite housing. If they pick up even a small charge, E&M is such a strong force that this provides some coupling between the proof mass and the satellite housing, and this can be give a fairly large electromagnetic force on Lisa's proof mass. This is actually right at the level of their sensitivity. This, in their error budget, this is as large as anything else. By contrast, atoms are completely neutral, and they don't charge. So we just don't have that kind of electromagnetic coupling. It's reduced. It's dipole, and it's far from the satellite. So it's essentially irrelevant. Another similar issue, Lisa has these macroscopic proof masses. Even with a very good vacuum, another thing that's at the end their error budget, at the same level, at this level of sensitivity, if you get small collisions with atoms in the background gas, in this vacuum, they accelerate Lisa's proof mass and they look like noise to Lisa. By contrast, we have some cold atom cloud floating through this vacuum. If some particle from the vacuum does come in, some background gas particle does come in and hit the cloud, well, it doesn't actually hit the cloud, it just hits one atom. It gives that atom a large momentum kick and knocks it out of the cloud. It just travels off in some random direction, and it no longer participates in the interferometer. It just won't even see the final beam splitter pulse. It won't be read out as a phase one way or another. So you do lose one atom from that. You lose some sensitivity, but it's not a noise source at all. The atom, this is one of the cute things about the atom interferometer, sort of self-cleaning. These are some reasons, but I want to stress this. You know, Lisa has been thought about very carefully. I'm certainly not a satellite expert. We've just begun to think about this kind of idea. So I'm certainly not claiming that this is sort of the end story, that this is the conclusion. I just want to say that there are some ideas, there are some exciting things about atom interferometry which might make this experiment potentially easier to do. What I really think is it should motivate serious consideration by people who are experts in all the fields that it takes to make one of these precise satellite experiments. Of course, I'm certainly not, so I can't claim to be. Okay.
What about the microwave background decoherent
of the atom? Good. So and in fact, even more than microwave background, we're presumably floating around, not shielded from the sun.
Well,
you can maybe do it on the dark side of the Earth, but anyway, there's cosmic rays and lots of stuff. So turns out that the atoms are essentially invisible. They don't have any molecular structure. They just have sharp resonances in the electromagnetic spectrum. They only respond to a few precise frequencies, some of which are microwave, but they're so sharp that the vast majority of this energy flies right through, even from the sun. So as Mark Kasparich likes to say, he can do the experiment in his room with the lights on. Doesn't it? Okay, good. So, other questions?
Yeah, I have a question. We have them in free space, but you have a lot of depletion of your material.
Let's see, of the cloud, you mean?
Yeah, the cloud.
Good. So this is why, I haven't really said why, but this is why it needs to be very cold. This is why you can only get about 1 million atoms per shot. And this is why you need to use all this new technology that led to VECs, all this new laser cooling, evaporative cooling, all that stuff. So the atoms' thermal velocities are actually exceedingly small, maybe hundreds of microns per second or less. So the cloud just doesn't spread very much. They're just very cold. They got one coherent laser kick from the laser. So they travel in the direction we'd like them to travel in, but they don't have much random thermal velocity to them.
And you're saying in free space, the cooling time is less than
the time it takes to cool. So that's dependent on how good a job these atomic experiments have done. Oh yes, good. I should have said, but this is one of the things that limits. We actually can't. You might think you could consider arbitrarily long times, but of course you can't. For that exact reason, you can only consider interferometer times that are now maybe up to about 1,000 seconds. So you've gone from maybe 1 second to 1,000 seconds, but there you're hard limited, because if you just calculate n sigma v for the space vacuum, you get about one collision on each atom in every 1,000 seconds. So after about 1,000 seconds, your entire cloud is destroyed. So actually, for the sensitivity curves I'm about to show you, we'll only consider 100 seconds to make sure that you still have most of your cloud remaining.
So to run it for a long period of time, you have to take a lot of gas up there because you've got to keep spewing it out.
Oh, yeah, except that you were only talking about 1 million atoms per shot, so yeah, even a small piece of material.
You want to do it for you, probably.
10 to 23 is pretty good.
what you
have to make a whole BEC problem.
So trivial, right? Turns out it doesn't probably have to be BEC. It's probably good enough just to be cool atom cloud, because I don't need them to all be in the same state. I just need them to be pretty cold so they don't spread. But I certainly agree, though, it's not trivial. I mean, completely. Obviously, no one has ever put this atomic technology in space, right? I mean, it's never been done. So I completely agree. There's some of them, I mean, these things do work essentially automatically. Like I said, no one has to test them, they just work every shot. But still, it's, I mean, anytime you're making a space experiment, it's a big problem, right? You only have one shot to get it right. Okay.
What's the limit you get on the duration from just the atomic physics? Is it the k time of this?
It depends on the atom you choose to use, but there are many atoms that can be longer than 1,000 seconds. Some are shorter. It depends on the levels you actually choose. In fact, I didn't say it, but you could come back. You don't have to transition from state 1 to state 2. You can come back to the same level for the accelerometer, not the atomic clock, but for the accelerometer, because we're actually just using the spatial splitting. So that's called a Bragg. You can just use a Bragg translation instead of Raman. Okay.
Last question about that. So one number is missing, you know, what is the difference in price tags?
That's missing for an excellent reason, which is I am just the particle theorist. I'm certainly not an expert in satellite physics, so I can't tell you what it costs, really. I mean, any satellite experiment is expensive, of course. Some of the technologies, similar to LISA, you do need some amount of drag freeness. Now, I imagine this is a lot easier to do. This is one of the challenges of LISA, but I really can't give you a price tag other than to say, you know, it's probably in the ballpark of these big space experiments.
You would need the same rough order of magnitude in terms of mass, the same kinds of
orbits. Right, exactly. Probably the same size satellite. For various technical reasons, LISA has to be in a solar orbit. We might be able, because of the smaller baseline actually, to be able to be in an Earth orbit. That might be somewhat cheaper. But
your equipment's not particularly heavy, it's the same kind of satellite scale.
Yeah.
The real question is, I think, LISA, as you say, the satellite problems are the main unknown. The rest is really automated. Nobody's going to go out and service these things. So you have to get something that works for 2, 3, 4, 5 years.
Right.
With no human touching anything.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Exactly. It's impossible for me to judge what it takes to build one of these satellites.
Couldn't your experiment be moon based?
Well, potentially. I don't know if that makes it easier.
Once you have mind shifts on the moon.
Yeah, that's definitely a feature. Okay, so here are projected sensitivities. So I'm plotting now the strain per root hertz of the gravity wave versus the frequency. This is LIGO sensitivity and LISA's projected sensitivity. And here, these red curves are our projected sensitivities for the terrestrial experiment. And I've shown two because, again, the much more careful work needs to go into this before you actually call it a real blueprint for an experiment. So I can't tell you exactly how well they're going to be able to do in all the many factors that go into this. So what we've assumed are made conservative and aggressive assumptions to sort of show you the range in which you might be able to lie, which this experiment might be able to do. One of them is, just one of the assumptions is, this has assumed a 1 kilometer mine shaft and this 4 kilometer, because 4 kilometers is the length of the longest shaft at Dussel. But there are other, again, there are other definite, this essentially uses atomic technology, which is already demonstrated. This kind of, this interferometer they're building at Stanford. This assumes some advances, which they're working on now, they think they're going to be able to do, but which are not demonstrated. So it might not work. Also, there in the red, the green and blue lines, I'm showing some possible sources, sort of picked randomly. White dwarf binaries and some intermediate mass black hole binary. 10 kiloparsecs is the size of the galaxy, and 10 megaparsecs is the distance to the local cluster, so where you might expect sources. The point I want to make is just, there are good reasons to, first of all, gravity waves are new band. You just want to look in as many frequencies as possible. You don't really know what you're going to see. You want sensitivity to all the possible sources. You can see this is sort of fitting between the projected LISA and the LIGO bands. There are some reasons to want sensitivity to lower frequency gravity waves. So neutron stars are one of the classic LIGO sources, because neutron star binary, as it spirals in, it gets closer and closer together. The frequency moves up. And of course, that ends just when the neutron stars collide. Neutron stars are small enough that they make it to frequencies as high as 100 to 1,000 hertz. But larger objects like white dwarfs or certain larger black holes, are too big and never actually make it into the LIGO frequency band, which is why they're not LIGO sources. And this is one of the reasons, of course, there are a lot of white dwarfs, and black holes would be interesting to see. So one of the reasons that you want to look at lower frequencies. Roughly, it's usually easier to make an astrophysical source that goes around itself at a lower frequency. It's hard to make one, say, at 100 Hertz.
This is nowhere close to gravitational waves from inflation.
No, and I'll get to that in a second. Yeah, I'll show those plots in a second. Absolutely.
Is that LIGO curve the current LIGO or the advanced?
That's current LIGO, not advanced LIGO. Yeah. So actually, sorry, this is stopping at like 30 Hertz. Advanced LIGO will be going down all the way to like 10 Hertz or whatever. So, and have somewhat more sensitivity, maybe they think an order of magnitude. Absolutely. Yeah. We're cut off here just by the sampling rate, so there's some limit to how fast you can make these shots. So this is the Nyquist frequency. And I've dashed, so this is just the sort of background shot noise, the pure sensitivity of the device. I've dashed the curve here below where you can't trust it anymore because it's below this time-varying gravity gradient noise. So below here, you can't trust this, the gravity gradient noise is presumably gone in the background, but we don't know how big it'll be, so I can't plot it here. But I don't know exactly how big it'll be. Okay, so like I said, these are our curves for the satellite, the projected curves for the satellite experiment. So again, these blue curves are some more conservative assumptions, atomic technology that's already been demonstrated, and more aggressive here, so this is showing you a range. I'm also plotting this sort of purplish curve in a different color. This assumes several technology upgrades that they're working on, but are definitely futuristic. So I can talk about those more if you want, but first just think, sort of with today's or even some small advancements of today's technology, you can maybe get in here, and there's some possibility for doing better. Potentially. The reason I'm plotting this, though, is if the atomic technology makes improvements, you do make improvements in sensitivity. So the important point is we have managed to get rid of the systematic backgrounds.
What are the improvements?
Okay, so there are several ways to make improvements. First, atom flux, if you can cool and trap more atoms. So they've been sort of steadily increasing the size of the EECs. Second, the number of momentum kicks. So I've always described it as if it's just two photon kicks, or one photon kick to the atom. But once you've separated them, there's theoretically, no reason, you can't grab one half of the atom and give it a lot more kicks. And this is actually something they've already demonstrated up to about 10 photon kicks. And this Stanford experiment plans to demonstrate up to several hundred photon kicks. This is the sort of thing they make progress in, you know, every year or two. So we're projecting here that they'll be able to do that.
What?
And here we're projecting they'll be able to do
that.
So
how does that help?
So the more momentum kicks you can give to the atom, the more spatial splitting you have, which increases, essentially, K comes into the phase shift. So increases the sensitivity of the device. Also, though, this curve is relying on something they're only working on and has never been demonstrated, even sort of to begin with, which is a squeezed source of the atom. So I don't know if you're familiar, people sometimes talk about squeezed sources of light for LIGO. You squeeze either phase or number noise and give up the other one. To gain more sensitivity. So this is also something that they're working on. Several groups around the world are working on. I know Mark Kasevich at Stanford has a group who's actively working on demonstrating a squeezed atom source, but it's never been done. And many people think it's gonna be very hard. So that's one of the improvements here. Also, I'm assuming 100, 1,000, and 10 to the 4 kilometer baselines, which is, as I said, somewhat dependent on laser technology or the kinds of atoms you can find. Okay. Oh, and also one of the small interesting features, like I said, we're not being limited by systematics here, which is nice. You're only being limited essentially by shot noise in something like this region. So you can imagine doing better. Also, our curve remains flat here, whereas Lisa's turns up. Lisa's shot noise here turns up. Because at this point, Lisa's got a long baseline, 5 million kilometers, so it's becoming longer than the wavelength of the gravity wave. Whereas, like I said, we have a relatively shorter baseline, so our curve doesn't turn up till much later. This time, of course, is the interrogation time of the interferometer. So I've taken here, you can see, about 100 seconds. Okay, so this is the sensitivity to astrophysical sources. I want to briefly talk about our sensitivity to cosmological sources. So this is always parameterized in terms of this parameter omega, which is the fractional energy density in gravity waves versus the critical density per logarithmic frequency interval. So some of the sources that, and the idea is you have these, all these sources will give some stochastic background of gravity waves, not a single source, not a single signal, but some large stochastic background with just some energy density in it that you can see if you cross-correlate two or more detectors. Okay, so some of the sources people have talked about. So inflation reheating, inflation unfortunately gives a fairly flat spectrum with what is a very low value of omega, 10 to the minus 15 or less, 10 to the minus 15 even for high scale inflation. That's probably unobservable at these experiments or any other currently planned experiment to look directly for gravity waves. Reheating, not surprisingly, picks a scale and so can give a peak spectrum which can be much larger at that scale, potentially observable. Similarly, phase transitions in the early universe, again, pick a scale and can give strong gravity waves that could be observed. One of the interesting or lucky coincidences is if you have an electroweak scale phase transition, only strongly first-order phase transitions give a gravity wave signal because you need these nucleation of bubbles which then collide and can produce gravity waves. One of the interesting or lucky coincidences is if you have an electroweak scale phase transition, they produce gravity waves whose frequency is about Hubble at that time. Redshifted down today, that turns out to be a frequency of about 10 to the minus 3 hertz, which is right in the band for these satellite experiments, which is very lucky and also pretty exciting, makes you think you really might be able to see some signals of new TeV scale physics in these low-frequency gravity wave detectors. So, for example, Randall and Servant discussed the TeV scale phase transition in RS1. They found, in some cases, a definitely observable amount of gravity waves. Or, as we heard this morning, if you have some new physics models, say in SUSY models, you can, in some recent parameter space, get strong first-order phase transitions, which can give observable gravity waves. Also, people here have discussed cosmic strings, and there are many other sorts of gravity waves. Now, of course, these are all speculative. We don't know they exist, but that's part of what makes them exciting. I mean, gravity waves are really telling you something about early universe cosmology. They're probing before the surface of last scattering. They may be telling you something, hopefully telling you something about high energy physics. One of the reasons to look for them. So here are our sensitivities in this variable omega versus the frequency of the gravity wave. This is LIGO's current bound from Science 1.4, and this is their projected initial bound. These red curves are, again, our projected terrestrial sensitivities. This bound here comes from a total integrated amount of energy density and gravity waves can't be more than about 10 to the minus 5, so it doesn't screw up BVN and the CMB. Here's Lisa's limit. And again, I've dashed them below where you can't really believe them. So you can see, certainly this experiment is already clearly not going to be sensitive to any sources, but presumably. But this experiment is maybe starting to get in the regime where some of these sources can be. Now, I'm not really going to draw these sources on there. They're more speculative. They're very model dependent, of course. Many models don't even give gravity waves. And even some of them, there are calculational uncertainties. It can be difficult to know how much gravity waves you get out of these models. So I can't draw sources on. They sort of start in here somewhere and go down, depending on what the source is. This curve starts to be sensitive to some of them. But really, for these kind of sources, you do probably have to go to space, unfortunately, either for light interferometers or atom interferometers. And that's because space is probing, well, it has more sensitivity, these experiments, but also it's probing lower frequencies. And this variable omega, experiments are sensitive to H strain. So an experiment, roughly, noise sources come like strain. But new physics tends to give sources with some fixed omega, some fixed energy density. And there's a frequency to the fourth relation between them, which means you win a lot by being at lower frequencies. That's why Lisa's curve here is much more sensitive than LIGO's, for example. Now, you could ask, is this a fair variable? Does this just make low frequencies look good? So that's why I'm plotting it. I think it's roughly fair. Inflation is fairly flat in this variable, so flat in frequency. Cosmic strings are fairly flat. And phase transitions, if you move the scale of the phase transition, it'll keep about the same energy density dumped into the universe, just change the frequency at which it occurs. Okay, and so also, like I mentioned, here's a curve taken randomly from this paper by Randall and Servant for the phase transition to RS1. I'm sure they picked a curve that was close to observable. But it does tell you kind of what it looks like. This, you can see it's TeV scale, so it's peaked about 10 to the minus 2 hertz. And it is, in many cases, there are certainly many models where it is an observable signal. So could be exciting also, like I said, in some NMSSM models, for example. Okay, so let's see. Okay. So I've tried to argue that atom interferometry provides a very new tool for looking for gravity waves, and it can change some of the rules of the game. It can reduce or eliminate some of the backgrounds that plague light interferometers. We've proposed two specific experiments, one on the Earth, sensitive to waves with frequencies around Hertz, one in space, sensitive to lower frequencies. And it seems that the sensitivities that at least may be achievable with these experiments are enough to allow the observation of many possible sources of gravity waves, many known or astrophysical sources that we think really have to exist, and also many more speculative cosmological sources, essentially because the gravity waves are such a new band, the universe is transparent, you can really see before last scattering. So they're really providing you with a lot of information that we don't have another way to get. And I think this is one of the reasons that looking for gravity waves is pretty exciting. So, thank you.
Questions?
I guess everybody keep on.
Go ahead.
What are the prospects of using atom interferometry with a spatially open interferometer to detect the lens Turing effect and confirm or deny another Stanford experiment?
Excellent question. So we've thought about this. And I should say the best we've been able to do is this sort of a setup. So this is a space diagram now, and you take a spatial opening for the atom interferometer. But the problem is that this, so I've said why it's sensitive roughly to acceleration. So forget the GR calculation, let's just say, what's the acceleration from lens Turing? Well, roughly, on the surface of the Earth, it looks like a phi correction to the Coriolis force. So phi being the Earth's gravitational potential, which is about 10 to the minus 9. So it's a tiny, tiny signal under the Coriolis background, which is why to pick it out, you need to take, or the way we've thought of, I should say, to take is to take two simultaneous vertically displaced atom gyroscopes. An atom gyroscope just means the same thing I told you, but split spatially, that it's sensitive to rotations, that's all. Again, run with the same laser pulses to get rid of all the noise sources I talked about. The problem is, this is our best idea. The problem is, this seems a little discouraging. So with initial numbers, if this is something like the size of the experiment that's being built at Stanford, this 10-meter tower, it's maybe four orders of magnitude below. The lens Turing effect at order one is four orders of magnitude below the initial sensitivity. Now, there are improvements. It's not actually ridiculous to imagine they're going to make four orders of magnitude progress, but it's certainly in the future. So that's why we stopped thinking about it. This is our best idea. Now, there may well be others. In general, I think this is a pretty new tool, and there's a lot of good ideas to be had, and we have not necessarily thought of everything at all.
Other questions? So the instrument, tell us about what's being built now and what it will be used for.
Oh, the experiment at Stanford?
Yeah.
So right now, in the basement of the Stanford Physics Building, they're building this 10-meter tower to house 10-meter atom interferometer. And the idea is that you just run two, again, simultaneous atom interferometers with these two isotopes in order to test the principal equivalence.
But that's all they're going to use it for.
Well, that's all they were going to use it for. And then Mark Kasevich started bragging to us about how good his experiment was, how sensitive it was. And then we started thinking, well, what else can you use this technology for? And I didn't discuss it, but there are some GR tests that I think actually it can start to be used for. In fact, I believe this device is just sensitive enough to start testing a couple of post-Newtonian GR effects at order 1 or maybe 10%. So that's the part I didn't get to, but we've written that up.
Sorry, those are things that have been probed.
Oh, good, I should say. So this can start testing at 10%. Solar system tests have already tested them at either 4 or 5 digits, depending on beta or gamma, which I'm talking about. Now, technically this is on the Earth, so it's sensitive to shorter range violations of GR. Solar system tests are sensitive to longer, but there isn't necessarily a good motivation for one distance or the other.
So in LIGO, one talks a lot about having to build a library of templates, because the expected signal is well buried in the noise, and you've got to really dig it out. So in your scenario, is there a similar problem?
Yeah, absolutely. It is not buried in noise sources coming from vibrations or something, but it's still buried just in shot noise. Just in, you're actually measuring a number of atoms, and that's subject to shot noise. So you can only do so well. And in those sensitivity curves I showed you, I've already assumed we have all those templates, and we're looking for a signal that we know, or cross-correlating between two detectors, for example. So I've compared the sensitivity, the signal strength to the per shot, per hertz sensitivity, not.
LIGO doesn't intend to run, isn't running with just one detector.
Yeah.
But you talked as if you could, so you actually can't run the bond detector. You have to have coincidences.
Well,
LIGO, the curves you show.
Just like with LIGO, no, you can run with one detector. LIGO will be running with one detector, but to prove to anyone, for any.
Two detectors, three.
Well. So, okay, it depends what you mean.
Three experiments, and they're looking
yes,
for...
Yes, right, absolutely, and you definitely want that, because although that doesn't improve their sensitivity curve, the per root hertz...
Yeah,
it doesn't improve the per root hertz sensitivity curves. What it does is improve your belief in your confidence
it's
in a measurement.
Discovery rate significant.
And you absolutely want that. I mean, for any gravity wave, nobody's going to believe in gravity wave signal unless you have two...
You didn't discuss that, because, I mean... LISA has that, therefore, three satellites.
Exactly, and so that is an extra complication, but we would absolutely want three as well.
Oh.
Absolutely, and just like, it's really the same sort of signal as LIGO. No, absolutely, sorry, I should absolutely say it needs to be the same sort of configuration. You need more than one to be sure you have detection. I mean, no one will believe it. Certainly look for a stochastic
and
source.
And terrestrial as well.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So you always need more than one.
And presumably at different places on the Earth.
Yeah, you want them pointing in different directions. Probably. Certainly, also, if you want pointing information, you want more than one, which probably for a lot of astrophysical sources, you do
How much does this experiment cost?
Sorry?
How much does this experiment cost?
Oh, so this experiment was put together by two grad students working for a couple of years, and the parts cost about $100,000. So that's why it doesn't seem crazy to us to imagine expanding this technology, to imagine that you could make it bigger. But yes, absolutely, you want to.
So as far as the equivalence principle goes, right, I mean, there are a number of experiments now in the works, Apache Point and Microscope, I think, that still flies.
Right.
In 2009, they could push it down to this 10 to minus 15
right.
level. So are you limited somehow there, or what are the prospects for pushing down to the level at which string theory will predict a violation of the equivalence principle?
So, you mean, is this limited?
What did he say?
We predict that.
Sure, space-time breaking down. Okay, what are the prospects of going down to say 10 to minus 20?
Okay, yeah, so that's a question I can address. So, this experiment will be limited to 10 to minus 15. They had a satellite version of this experiment. So that's why it's funded by NASA, actually. That got killed when we decided to go to Mars. But it could potentially have made several order of magnitude improvement. And like I said, I mean, this is the level they're at now. They've been making orders of magnitude progress in the past. So it's at least reasonable to believe that they may well keep doing that in the future.
So there's no noise source or something?
So on the Earth, there are noise sources. So far, they've been controllable, but they're absolutely a problem. There are several, but the biggest one is probably the extent to which these two clouds can be co-located. So if they're not at the same point, they feel slightly different gravity from the Earth, and that's a background.
Okay, thanks.
Good, thanks again.